Hello everyone and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. We are in our 40th installment and this is Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand and I have my own blog at thenerdstremira.blogspot.com. And with me as always is my illustrious co-host.
I like the sound of that. I'm Sean T. Collins. I'm a television critic for various publications including Rolling Stone where I cover Game of Thrones. I am the co-author of the official annotated Game of Thrones for the Subtext iPad app with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and the World of Ice and Fire and series editor Anne Grohl. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and a Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones blog located at BoiledLeather.com, which is probably where you found this podcast. Today we are actually kind of going back in time into the history of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour.
Oh, yes, we're doing that. It is a way long time ago in those olden days of glory in which we started a series which we called The Women of Westeros. And for some time, we haven't picked up the thread, but we always had material for one last episode to conclude the series. And that's what we're going to do today. And we will be talking about Arya, about Lyanna, about the Sand Snakes, about Ygritte, and about Arianne, and how they all fit together or not. That will be decided this episode. So, Sean, let's start with Arya, shall we?
Sure. Arya is a bizarrely controversial character, I would say, at this point.
She is?
I think so. You know, obviously she kind of leapt right out of the gate as a major fan favorite. Because she is an appealing figure, you know, particularly in comparison to most of her siblings who are a little bit more difficult to like in the early going. Not that I disliked them, you know, not that but I'm just saying Arya has personality. She's got get up and go. She's active participant. You know, she breaks the mold. She's a tomboy. She's cool. She's fun. She's exciting. She's adventurous.
And then she starts killing people.
Well, that's the point at which she becomes controversial, because the last time I did any real serious writing about Arya was a couple of years ago. And I got a lot of flack for saying that, you know, something's going badly wrong with Arya insofar as she's now killing people in pretty cold blood. And Arya fans, a small but vocal subset of Arya fans, was upset that I characterized her in this way, arguing that other characters, male characters, Sansa, do worse things but don't get, or differently bad things but don't get the disapproval that Arya gets. And you know, I guess my point is that she's a character with whom I think a lot of the audience identifies, either because they felt similarly out of touch with the values propagated by their family or their, you know, town or whatever. And also just because she's a really endearing, engaging character for a very, very long time before she starts to get a little bit more creepy than engaging. So the path that she's on in the most recent books and then also in the preview chapters, which I don't know if we'll go into or not, and certainly on the show, which, you know, is broadly congruent with her trajectory in the books, is, you know, that's challenging work on Martin's part, and on Benioff and Weiss's part. They're taking a character that's very lovable and making her a bit more difficult to love, I would say. Not empathize with, but, you know, just enjoy, like, woohoo! You know.
Yeah, I would argue that it isn't even necessary to take the preview chapters or the series to see that she's definitely going down in a darker path, because since she is a POV character, we are in her thoughts, and we experience this process in which she is developing away from a child to this killer persona thing, how she becomes more cold-blooded, how revenge is taking an ever stronger place in her mind, how she first decides to kill someone who she doesn't even have a direct connection with when she assassinates Darien. All that kind of stuff is in there until the end of A Feast for Crows. So there is a clear trajectory into a darker direction, which is, in my eyes, perfectly coherent with what Martin generally does. Because one of his major points has always been that revenge isn't exactly something that will give you a good night's sleep afterwards. And Arya's arc is one of those, together with the Dornish, I guess, in which this point is made most prominently. Because, I mean, her list is getting shorter, not necessarily because of stuff she does, but the list is getting shorter, but she isn't getting any happier.
That's a great point. Yeah. That's a good question. Like, what becomes of Arya at a point where every name is checked off the list? Is she then better? It's difficult to imagine a circumstance where that is the case. And another thing I wanted to bring up about Arya is that, again, in the pushback that I got when writing about her character, you know, I think it was pointed out fairly strenuously that she's been suffering emotional and physical abuse at the hands of these people that she's been sort of tossed into. And that's true. And I think, like Sansa and Bran both in their ways, Arya is getting, like, an overdose of what she thought she wanted. Like, it was a real monkey's paw kind of situation, where, you know, she wanted to fight, and she wanted to be brave, and she loved all these stories about warriors and warrior women and stuff. And in the same way that Bran was like, oh, you want to be a hero? You know, this is what your heroic journey is going to be like. You're never going to walk again, and you're going to give up being human, and you're never going to see anyone you care about again. And Sansa was like, oh, you like knights and princesses and ladies and princes and towers and shit? Well, eat it. You know, it actually sucks. Like, that's kind of what Arya's gotten. Like, oh, you know, you like swordplay and fighting and adventure? Well, you know, have fun with Yoren and Jaqen H'ghar and the Hound and all these, you know, like, awful professional killers that she meets up with and learns from one by one.
That's an interesting point. I mean, what does she really learn? Because Sansa quickly realizes that all that she ever wanted was more or less on the wrong track. She needs one or two attempts in some things. I mean, it requires Ser Donchas so that she finally decides that she can only rescue herself and not trust Littlefinger and all of that. But she pretty quickly comes around the idea that those knights and lords and all that kind of stuff doesn't work as advertised. But for Arya, this realization seems still to be coming. She is learning from professional killers, some things at least, mm-hmm. and she really gets hard and she gets professional and all that, but I have the feeling that her realization, this moment where she realizes that, and we as readers realize, that something is amiss here, that it doesn't work that way, that is still to be coming.
Yeah, I think so. Because none of the patterns established in the lives of these men that she's kind of come under their tutelage, like, are viable for her. You know, she doesn't want to be the Hound. He was a piece of shit in a lot of ways, and miserably unhappy and angry, and she hated him as much as she also kind of loved and respected him. She also genuinely hated him. And then, you know, Yoren taking the black is not an option for her, and I think she's kind of discovering that the House of Black and White and the Faceless Men she's giving it the old college try, but you know, obviously she hid her own sword. She knows on some level that this is not for her, and she's and so on. So I think that I hope anyway that when she's removed from direct contact and influence with these figures in any way, she'll have, like, literally the time and the energy, the mental energy, to think things through and be like, there's got to be a better way than living to kill, you know?
I want to come back to this point a little bit later. Before, mm-hmm. I want to ask one other question, which is, Arya, as well as all the other women we have in our episode today, is often considered as the strong women, you know? I mean, many women in the Song of Ice and Fire are pretty weak, quote-unquote, in that they are not really masters of their own fate and they're pushed around a lot. That's something you can't say of Arya, really.
That's true. So
how is she really a strong woman in that sense? And what does strong woman even mean?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't want to speak for you. Maybe I do. But, you know, I do want to assure the readers that when we talk about strong female characters, we're obviously using strong in the sort of societal definition, I think, and what that term has sort of come to mean. Not that we genuinely think that Sansa or Cersei are quote-unquote weak for failing to, like, be sword-wielding badasses or whatever.
Yes.
You know, that requires a different strength of its own. And then I also think that, like, let's say they completely fell apart. Let's say they were the Veronica Cartwright character in the first Alien film. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're... Then it becomes a question of, what are you saying is strong? Are you saying they're physically strong? Are you saying they're emotionally, mentally strong? Or are you saying the writing is strong? That, to me, is what matters more than anything else. And I wish that the conversation about... And I'm sure most people do, or a lot of people do, wish that the conversation around strong female characters just meant, like, this person's not a cliché. This person, the writer actually has given this person a fully formed personality. They're not just doing stuff because that's what that character is supposed to do. It can be someone who completely falls apart. Like, I fucking love, speaking of Alien movies, Bill Paxton's character in the second Aliens film completely loses his shit. But that's a great character. That, to me, is what I think of if I were to use the phrase strong character, like, that character, the writing is strong. He's not, but the writing is. And I kind of wish that that were more the emphasis, because then it wouldn't matter if Arya is, you know, someone to look up to or not. Then it wouldn't matter if Arya is a wonderful person who's doing the best she can with the shit hand she's been dealt, or if she's becoming, you know, kind of a sociopath. It wouldn't, like, that, because you're not talking about a role model, you're talking about a character. And I do wish that the discussion about strong female characters would center more on, like, is the writing any good, rather than, like, is this a good person?
You're definitely speaking for me, because that's one of the problems I have if people are always talking about strong characters, because there is always this implicit premise that strong means your classic picture of masculinity, you know, with muscles and go down fighting and all that kind of stuff. And this does not only keep women down or commits them to the same stupid stereotype, but it also keeps other male characters down. For just one example would be the Reader of Horlaw, who is a pretty cool guy in my book, but he never would pass any test about being strong,
right,
in the traditional sense. And if you look at a character like Brienne, for example, she doesn't really manage to fulfill the male standards for being a strong fighter persona, because many people complain she's always a bit whiny and stuff, but that's what makes her strong. Because if Martin would have written her as just some badass fighting chick, which is arguably a direction that the show took a little bit, then she would become more of a cartoon and not be a strongly written character. So I guess we're on the same page here, that a strong shouldn't really mean being able to kill people.
Yeah, and I also, you know, I just want to state again, nor should it mean, like, well, they're strong in other ways, necessarily. Because it really bothers me, the idea that, like, let's say Sansa was a complete asshole, you know, who was selling people out. Like, you may not like her, but so what? Like, she's not... I said this, I think, last time with Stannis, when I said Stannis is not Beyonce. You don't need Stannis to be an admirable, wonderful figure, a role model, an idol. You don't need him to be your friend. You just need him to be interesting on the page or on the screen. And I think the same is true with Sansa. Like, I don't like the idea that the only proper way to appreciate a character is to position them as some sort of faultless moral paragon whose mistakes or bad deeds or flaws are owed entirely to what other people have done to them. Like, that's not interesting to me. I'm interested in characters who fuck up completely on their own, you know, because they're not perfect. Because I don't need, like, it just seems childish to me, literally, yeah, to want a character to look up to at all times, or to protect like a fragile little baby bird. You know, Arya doesn't need that from anybody.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. You know, Arya is a fascinating character, a really, 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 really fascinating character.
Which brings me back to this point that I promised I would go back to. Mm-hmm. And that's the question of where will her journey go? Because to me, it seems pretty obvious that Martin has put out many, many hints in Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons especially, that she will not totally succumb to the ideology of the Faceless Men.
Yeah.
And at some point, there has to be a break with the sect. And the question is when, where, and under which circumstances. And many theories go that she will have to assassinate someone she knows, and then she will snap back or something. But I'm really interested in your take on this.
Well, I assume that at some point she'll wind up back with her wolf pack, with Nymeria's wolf pack, in the Riverlands somehow. But beyond that, you know, I don't know. I'm really bad at predicting, in addition to the kind of... Well, I'm just really bad at it. But I agree with you that I don't think... I think she will be pulled back from the brink. I really do. I you know, maybe that's foolish or overly optimistic, but I do believe that she's not going to... I mean, it would be one hell of a story if Arya became like an irredeemable monster. That would
She won't.
No, I don't think she will. I don't think she will. It just seems to me that she has retained a certain core of goodness, as symbolized ironically in hanging on to her own sword. That I don't think can be purged from her, no matter what the circumstances. That's just how it reads to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also really not sure what will happen, but I guess it is a given that she will encounter Nymeria again, which will put her somewhere in the Riverlands, but I have no clue how this will happen or what her target will be. But something is bound to happen. There are so many scenes in which she remembers her Stark heritage and is constantly reminded that she is a Stark and feels like it. And really, Martin isn't the writer to put that in there just for fun.
Right.
So something has to happen with it. And so that it can gain any traction, she first has to become no one, at least in a great part, or else it wouldn't make any drama. So that's, in very rough terms, where I see her going. Mm-hmm. She will definitely pull back from the brink and not become an irredeemable monster. And by the way, the same is true of Bran. He's not the great other, just to have said that once.
Yes. Not worth saying at any time, I would say.
Yeah. So do you have any additional thoughts on Arya?
No, I think we can move on. We got a lot to cover, man.
Yeah, we got to shake it up. But our next character should be a little bit shorter because we don't know really that much about her. It's Arya's aunt, Lyanna, who Arya is frequently compared to, and I guess one of fandom's favorites. I mean, I named my daughter after her, so there is at least some attraction to her. So, what do you think about her?
Well, she's sort of like like Rhaegar, she is one of these characters that is really only visible through this Rashomon-like lattice work of dueling perspectives, memories, points of view, political backgrounds, you know, because we never meet her. Not only is she not a point of view character, like, I mean, Egret, who I think we're going to be talking about, you only ever see her from Jon's point of view and, you know, which is a specifically male point of view, but she at least is around. You can at least hear her through her own words directly.
Yeah.
And Lyanna, you don't even have that because she's dead. And so she's almost wholly presented to us through these filters of the people who remember her and or who heard about her. And it's one of the central melancholy mysteries of the series that she and Rhaegar are so important and yet so alien to our actual experience of the story through the people participating in it in the here and now. I think that makes her a very, very interesting figure. Now, what that says about her as a person, I don't know. She seems like a real character. She seems like a person who marched to the beat of her own drum in a way that was supported to an extent by her family and her culture.
Yeah, but extent.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, you like you said, you named your daughter after her, so you tell me what's up with Lyanna.
Okay, what I find fascinating in the context of the story, especially if you talk about comparing her to Arya, is that she seems to me like a sadder version of Arya. Of course, sad only until the coup in King's Landing happens, because then everything goes to shit. But before, because we know that she loved to ride, we know from Bran's vision that she also liked to sword fight and stuff, and we know from Eddard that she wasn't really allowed to go through with all of this by her father Rickard. So it seems to me that Ned, when he allows Arya to go through with all her tomboy and stubbornness and all that kind of stuff, he always has this image of Lyanna in his head and how he wants to make it better this time, which to me seems like she wasn't really happy. I don't think she was sad or melancholic all the time or something, but she was definitely more constrained than Arya ever was. And that is one thing I find fascinating about the connections in between this family and how you get this image of it only by third-party ideas. I mean, some of our information about Lyanna comes from Lady Dustin, but still, there is this real sense of how she ticked and what brought her to be the mystery knight in the Journey of the False Spring and all that kind of stuff. And then on the other hand, as you already mentioned, there is this doomed romance with Rhaegar, which is just a story I've always found very, very fascinating.
Yeah,
and so those are the things that make me really interested in Lyanna. Plus, she has a really nice name.
It is a lovely name, for sure. I think that it seems the interesting thing. One of the interesting things about Lyanna is that she had this outsized personality. That the idea that she's this figure of destiny, that she's this linchpin in the larger narrative arc of, like, humankind's fate on this planet of theirs, actually fits rather nicely with her. And that's not always the case, I don't think. In A Song of Ice and Fire, often it is. Like, Daenerys has a big personality. Rhaegar obviously was a very compelling figure to people of his day. You know, Tyrion, I think, if you agree with me, that he's going to be a major prophetic figure.
Yeah.
You know, he's got maybe not necessarily the kind of personality you see as a, you know, as a great hero, but he's definitely got personality. Jon, less so. You know, Jon's sullen. That's kind of Jon's deal. He has an innate political strength, if not necessarily political know-how, that comes through in the end. You know, but it's an interesting contrast with someone like, say, Stannis, who does not have that kind of personality, is not a compelling figure, only through, like, just sheer dogged, gritted teeth determination does he kind of elbow his way to the front of the pack, and obviously it's not going to pan out for him. But I think that's an interesting thing about Lyanna. Like, if when you hear these stories, you know, the Mystery Knight story.
Yeah.
You know, just the kind of open, you know, the kind of clear-eyed understanding of the sort of man that Robert Baratheon was. You know, she didn't seem like she was freaking out about it. She was just like no dummy about it. She has a certain strength to her that if you were like, and yeah, you know, in some way she's, you know, she is the sort of Virgin Mary figure who's going to give birth to the Messiah. You're like, okay, yep, that makes some sense, you know.
You know what I think where she would have been happy is on Bear Isle. And I don't think that it is a chance that there is a Lyanna Mormont, a 10-year-old girl who mm-hmm. defies Stannis. She seems like there she would have really fit in, but the Starks are too high profile to really allow her to stray that far off.
Right, and I think that might be an interesting point too in terms of, I keep saying interesting, god damn it. People, you have my permission from now on. If I say interesting more than 3 times in a podcast, please get on the social network of your choice and harass me. You've got to get rid of this. So, I think there's maybe some kind of historical value to the idea that Lyanna probably would have been more at home in Bear Island or a place like that. But that wasn't an option if you believe in the Southron ambitions conspiracy and her dad trying to marry off all his kids to, like, important families from the South. Lyanna couldn't be happy in a culture where her kind of personality coupled with her gender made more sense. She was always going to be kind of traded off like a broodmare, as Cersei would put it, you know?
Definitely. That's what I mean. She's a little bit of a sad figure. Not tragic or anything. It wouldn't go as high profile as that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a certain sadness to her.
Right. And I suppose it goes without saying that we, in our discussion of Lyanna, are assuming that her relationship with Rhaegar was consensual.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Okay.
I think there can no longer be any doubt about this.
I would agree.
Not since the World of Ice and Fire.
Yeah, I agree.
That pretty much confirmed it. But okay, let's go to the Sand Snakes, and I want to emphasize that we don't talk about the TV version.
No, we don't.
Let's talk about the book version, and I want to start with saying that it is not like the book versions are that much better. I think the Sand Snakes are one of the, together with Darkstar, one of the lower points of A Feast for Crows.
Yeah, I mentioned this last time when we were discussing the show, but I've always found that many of the Dornish characters more interesting in theory than in practice. They're interesting for the potential that they represent as avatars of a different culture, as people who aren't ethnically based in that sort of like Northern European stock, as it were. Obviously, I think Martin has some different ideas about precisely who these people are than, let's say, Tumblr fandom does. And in circumstances like that, I would generally be forced to side with the person who invented the characters from whole cloth and the people who write about them and form their own ideas about them. But I do think maybe this is the linchpin. Maybe this is the way we can understand the Sand Snakes. You know, the Sand Snakes, there's so many of them. You don't see them for very long. None of them have POV chapters. They're all just kind of defined the way, like, interesting leaders of the bad guys in a Mad Max movie are defined. Like, they have a cool weapon, they have a cool outfit, you know, they have a... And they look slightly different than the rest of the people, and that's how they're distinguished. They're not, you know, which is cool. They're not fully formed characters, but thinking of them in terms of the difference that they represent, I think, is useful. And I was just thinking about it now in terms of there's a kind of meme concept that goes around that you'll see as a hashtag on Twitter called Carefree Black Girls. And the idea behind that is, you know, black women and black girls will, like, tweet pictures of, like, groups of cool people having a great time, being interesting and awesome and attractive and smart and successful, who happen to be black women or black girls. You know, like one of Obama's daughters and her cool friends, or like Rihanna and her cool friends, or whoever. So the point being that, you know, as a black woman in a racist, sexist, misogynistic, patriarchal society, white supremacist society, your opportunities to be completely carefree are really grotesquely limited. So just the simple act of surrounding yourself with people who are just having a good time and, you know, and enjoying, you know, being kind of awesome is a sort of political act in and of itself. And that idea, I think, obviously makes complete and total sense, and I think is super cool. And that, I think, is maybe what the Sand Snakes represent. Because of their background, their aristocratic lineage, coupled with Dorne's leniency on the idea of bastards and Dorne's relatively egalitarian approach to gender, they have a freedom to do their own thing that a lot of women in the world of the books don't have, and that a lot of women and other people reading the books would love to have. So I think that's maybe the compelling thing about the Sand Snakes. Not that, like, all of them are, like, you know...
killers?
Yeah. Not that all of them are killers, yeah. And not that all of... because not all of them are. And not that they're each and every one of them, like, a brilliant character, like, well-developed on the level of Tyrion or Sansa or whoever. Just that they, just the by existing the way they exist, are kind of symbolic of an opportunity that a lot of people find compelling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess so. I think they are really more wish fulfillment than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that they don't work that well in the way that Martin wrote them and anticipated them, I guess. Like he expected here. I have read only a few days ago where someone said, it was Wordzone in his really good write-up of the process of the books being written, that Martin more or less created the Dark Star as a cool character to like, you know, this one-time guy who is essentially a badass and hilariously misfired. And I guess it is the same thing with the Sand Snakes a little bit. They seem a little bit too cartoony, just a little bit too much over the top. Not much, but always a little bit. They always left me cold for some reason. And I can't really say what it is, but they are, I guess... what I talked about in the beginning, that if you take this male-centered idea of a violent badass as the definition of strong and simply slap it onto a woman, what you get are the Sand Snakes.
Right.
And I don't really know what their place in the narrative is. Still not.
Yeah, they seem like if they're going to matter, they're going to matter the most, in obviously, in the books that remain. Because there's still, you know, like the Greyjoy boys and like the other Tyrell sons, I think their moment has yet to come. But how would you... So, how would you contrast them with another figure from Dorne who is not a Sand Snake, but kind of like a...
She wants to be a Sand Snake.
Yeah, she's a Sand Snake, she's a Sand Snake... She's the head of the Sand Snake fan club, Arianne Martell.
I think Arianne can be compared really well to Lyanna, because she also wants to do things that are not really socially accepted the way she does them. Sleeping around is a little bit more accepted in Dorne, but the way she does it, this frank... just doing it for the gain, you know, as she does it with Aerys Okard, that even she pushes the boundaries too far, and she always runs into invisible boundaries that she hates, but she does not understand. And I think unconsciously she wants to be the head of the Sand Snake fan club, because since they are bastards, they don't have an official place in the aristocracy and in the hierarchies, and so it doesn't matter if they break the rules. But with Arianne, it matters if she breaks the rules. She can't be a Sand Snake. Right. She's the heir of Dorne, and that is something that she really doesn't understand and doesn't want to understand, and I'm doubtful that she really internalized the lesson yet. Officially, she has learned it, and she is now on this diplomatic mission to Aegon, but I really doubt that she has accepted and understood for her what that really means.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think the Sand Snakes represent her to her that, you know, carefree Dornish girls.
Yes.
That she, I think she would like to be in some way. Because sort of what we've seen from Arianne is a combination of being, trying to have her cake and eat it too. She wants to be free-thinking, free-living, you know, fuck you and your rules, which is great, because the rules really do suck most of the time. But she also wants to be this power player, this, you know, mover and shaker behind the scenes, you know, toppler of thrones and regimes, seeker of revenge. And we, you know, we obviously saw how that worked out. And so I think the person that she reminds me of most is less Lyanna than... honestly, an older version of Arya or Sansa, where she knows how she personally would prefer to live her life. She sees the models available to her for living her life. And the conflict, the contrast between that is what causes her problems.
You know what also might be a good comparison? Jaime Lannister.
Hell yes. Wow.
I think that is even better, because he is also the heir apparent, and he also doesn't give a damn, and he does what he likes. And he runs into invisible boundaries, he wants to have the cake and eat it. It's all there.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, oh man, absolutely. And the sexual indiscretions, and there's a Kingsguard element to it and everything, that is dead on, man.
Yeah. Oh, I'm proud of myself now.
You should be. You should be. And Arianne, I think, again, is a character who's going to be really fascinating to watch in the final two volumes, because, you know, people have gamed out based on what they think needs to happen with Dorne and Aegon and King's Landing and Dany, how things might go for the individual characters involved, and none of those theories work out particularly well for Arianne. But even if that winds up being the case and she fucks up again, I'm curious to see how her experiences with Myrcella, who she genuinely regrets involving the way she did, and hurting the way she did, how those experiences shape her to sort of maybe make errors in the opposite direction. I think she'll only get better as a character the more we spend time with her.
Yes, definitely.
You know?
That's
really,
not Aria Hotel.
No, there's really... What are you going to do? I think you made some mistakes with the POV chapters in Dorne. I don't think Arya should have had a POV. Aria Hotel, I think, was a mistake. I don't know why you wouldn't just give all of that to Ariane. I don't know.
I also don't understand it. But I think that Ariane will immolate pretty fast in the coming books. I mean, I take it as a given that she will marry Aegon VI and then become a very short-lived queen of Westeros and then watch it all go to hell.
What a bummer. What a bummer to think of the coming complete and total bloodbath down there.
Yes. but really, it's what makes the most sense, because that's what I just said with, she hasn't really internalized all the lessons. She pays lip service to them, and I guess she really honestly thinks that she understood what her father was teaching her, but she doesn't.
Right.
A bit like Cersei, but who also thinks that she understood all the lessons, but didn't. And both of them will go down because of it. And both of them will go down in King's Landing because of it. So.
Oh, man. Huh. Now I'm feeling kind of down about all this. What a bummer.
Yeah. Let's go to the love of his life that is killed. Just lighten the mood.
On a happier note, yes, let's talk about Ygritte. Like I said before, she's a little bit different than many of the other characters we've talked about in this series, because she doesn't have her own POV chapters, and she is seen exclusively through the eyes of a man who is in love with her, or falls in love with her, at least. And so that's worth examining in and of itself, I think. The way that Martin writes that experience of meeting someone, getting to know someone, falling in love with someone, so that their quirks and annoying characteristics become extremely endearing to you, I think he did that really well. Like, doesn't she have, like, a snaggle teeth or something like that? She's got...
Yes.
Right. And, you know, she's not portrayed as a great beauty, the way Daenerys is, or Cersei, or whoever. You know, the casting confuses this somewhat on the show, because Rose Leslie is gorgeous. But, oh boy. But I mean, she also, like, she's gorgeous in a way that's not, like, this kind of, like, you know, this kind of an edge to it. Which,
yeah.
I guess, that's a good way to go. But I mean, when I was thinking about preparing for this episode, the kind of thing that struck me the most about Ygritte is not necessarily larger socio-political points that we can draw about the wildlings in the north, and although there's plenty to say about that, but just that I'm interested. I just like them. I did it again, motherfucker. Interesting. just that I like how he wrote that experience of falling in love with somebody. And,
yes.
You know, it limits what we can glean about who Ygritte really is, because it's all seen exclusively through the eyes of the person who loved her. But that's an exercise I think worth undertaking.
Yes. A point I want to make about her is that in the hands of a lesser writer, I think she would have been an utter failure. Because there are so many tripping wires attached to her character. I mean, she is otherized as a member of another culture. If this was a Western, she would be a native Indian girl.
Mm-hmm.
And the cowboy falls in love with her or something. So Pocahontas type, you know.
Yeah.
And she's also a little bit badass, and she is very fluid in the mysteries, in the songs of the land, and you can see all the potential problems where this could veer hard into a stereotype area, but this is avoided because Martin is simply a great writer. So I think that is also something that makes her compelling. While she is written along certain formula that we came to know, she's still fresh and interesting enough, and you can never be quite sure about where this is exactly going. And Ygritte is such an uncompromising character in what she is, what she thinks she is, and what she thinks is right, and she does it, and to hell with the consequences. And in contrast to some other persons we know that are basically all going fuck the consequences, she owns the responsibility for it. You know, she always knows that if she does something like that, she is taking a risk, and that what it could cost her. She knows what she does when she lies for John. She knows what she does when she shoots him in the leg and not in the back, and stuff like that. And she is always very conscious about all of this, and she owns her decisions. I guess that is something that I really like about her.
Yeah, I agree with you. She's in an interesting... My God, damn it! Now I'm starting to sound like Bob Odenkirk on Mr. Show. God damn!
Yeah.
Her position is unique in that all of the wildlings are suddenly developing this sort of political consciousness that didn't exist up there before, because they've all been unified under a single leader for a single purpose, which is the good of all of them. You know, we see it for quite some time as the wildlings versus, you know, the Seven Kingdoms, and specifically the North, and that's true, and a lot of them see it that way as well. But Ygritte is kind of forced to be in the vanguard of this this army that has a political objective beyond just taking territory or, like, capturing your neighbor's goats or whatever. You know, it's an existential threat that she's facing. And so into this sort of changing dynamic for her is thrust this dude who was her sworn enemy until he went over to the other side. And, you know, I think for a lot of other characters, there would be... I think you're right to focus on the idea that she kind of takes ownership of all her actions, because I think a lot of other characters would just kind of go with the flow a little bit more when they're dealing with such challenging circumstances and take less personally difficult paths. And she didn't. Does that make sense? Am I making sense?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Because that's part of what's compelling about their relationship as well, is that it's not a relationship that could have happened at any other time. It's this one little unique window that opens and then closes again.
Yes.
You know, and that makes it... I don't know, I think the whole relationship is frightfully romantic.
Yes.
You know. And more so in the books than in the show. You know, I mean, the show gets there eventually. Like, I fucking love that scene when they're up on the top of the wall. But, you know, in the books, it was never all this kind of gross, single entendre, like, vulgar flirtation that she does with John at the beginning.
Yeah.
You remember that shit in season 2?
I really don't like it.
No, I didn't like it at all. I'm glad they got away from it eventually.
Yeah, it took them a great while. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you remember when she taunted him for Rhodes?
Yes.
What are they good for?
Oh, boy.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
It's a road.
Now, does Ygritte... Does she... how do you feel... What do you feel she does teach us about how women are treated by the wildlings? Or how women are viewed in wildling society?
A woman in wildling society isn't equal. I think that would be a misconception about them. But if a wildling woman manages to become what they call a spear wife, which essentially means, once again, owning up to the male perception of masculinity and all that kind of stuff. You know, if she can't stand her own, defend her own with a weapon in hand, so she basically becomes a man, then she is accepted more or less without reservations. But only then. And as far as I understood it from what we learned about the wildlings, is it that most of the wildling women are not spear wives, that they never own up, and therefore are more like personal... Yeah, not personal property, but much more dominated by their husbands than most. I think Ygritte is a little bit romanticizing the idea that the wildling women can kill their husband and they need to be stolen, and like this would be a contest of sorts. I think it doesn't work out that way most of the time, and that she is really a little bit romanticizing it here. But the wildlings open up more possibilities for women than most other societies we've seen.
That's true, yeah. It's kind of a step forward and a step back. For women in wildling society, you basically have two choices. You can be a thief, or you can be loot.
Yes. You know? Yeah, that's good.
Right, and whereas in the Seven Kingdoms, you have fewer chances for autonomy, but it does seem like you have... There's at least a little bit more of a conception that as a woman you are still a human who has certain rights.
You're more a prize than you are loot.
Yes. Yeah, I guess that's the way to put it. I mean, not that... Obviously, you know, marriage is still basically... You're still property and it's all transactional, but...
I don't want to defend Westerosi patriarchy.
No, not at all. Not at all, but... Yeah, I think, you know, things have worked out all right for Ygritte, so she does romanticize those circumstances a little bit. And she's also doing it to make John uncomfortable.
Yes. You know, yes.
She's razzing him, so that's understandable, too. But I like Ygritte. I wish she wasn't dead.
Yeah. It is really a much sadder scene in the book still. I think they did it well in the show, but you can't really beat this John going down and searching for her and not knowing whether or not he shot her and then her last words and all that kind of stuff. It is really...
Yeah. I'm glad that you said John going down, too, because I feel like any discussion of this character would be remiss if we didn't discuss John going down on her with the Lord's kiss.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, we have a good time. We laugh here on the Boiled Leather Audio Hour.
Yes. At least in the end, we laugh. But before, it was really sad. Lyanna dead, Ygritte dead, Arianne soon dead, Arya killing people.
Yeah. Hey, sand snakes are all right, I guess.
Yeah. Killing people as well.
Some of them. Some of them are studying. Some of them are getting an education.
Yeah, some of them are studying.
Yeah. You know, they're trying to better themselves. All right.
One at least.
What'd you say?
One at least.
Yeah, one. It's a cool one, though. She's got a cool nickname. She's pretty cool. So I think that's everything, is it not?
Yes, really, we concluded our Women of Westeros series after only, 2 years or something?
Yeah, I think the last one we did was 2 years ago. But thank you for your patience, everybody.
Yes.
And hopefully you won't require 2 years before we come back and do another episode.
Yeah, that would be really great. Yeah, so, okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, as always, and nice to have you. Until next time.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.